I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views. Few things rouse the emotions as much as politics and poetry. When you put the two together, it can be dynamite. And that is certainly the case with academic, diplomat, and poet Peter Dill Scott. Professor Scott has devoted a lifetime to understanding what he calls parapolitics or deep politics. That is to say, a form of politics that occurs alongside and parallel to everyday politics. Through this lens, he has cast a critical eye on powerful institutions like U.S. intelligence agencies, the American defense industry, and Wall Street. Put more simply, Professor Scott has been engaging in an academically inclined investigation of what can be called the American deep state. In fact, it could be argued that Professor Scott has played a pivotal role in popularizing the concept of the deep state to the American public. Don't be mistaken, however, his approach to these matters proves much more hard-nosed than the crude appropriation of ideas like the deep state in recent years by President Donald Trump and the American right wing. But Professor Scott is not merely a prolific prose writer. He is also an accomplished poet. And his fascination with history and deep politics bleeds into that aspect of his work as well. What sets his political poetry apart from his political prose, however, is a deeply personal element. For example, in his most famous poetic work, Coming to Jakarta, a poem about terror, Professor Scott not only examines the Indonesian massacres of the mid-20th century and the U.S. hand in those atrocities, but also the toll bearing witness to the historical reality of it all had on him. What does it mean to, as the Catholic theologian and social activist Thomas Merton would say, commit raids on the unspeakable, those atrocities that we would rather ignore. What psychic trauma does it incur to recognize those atrocities? And what is our culpability as citizens of a country involved in said atrocities? Coming to Jakarta, a poem about terror may hold the answer to some of those questions, or at the very least, the clues to them. On this edition of Parallax Views, Professor Peter Dill Scott and Freeman Ng join us to discuss their new book, Poetry and Terror, Politics and Poetics in Coming to Jakarta, which revisits Professor Scott's most famous work of poetry. And now, without any further ado, my conversation with Professor Peter Dill Scott and Freeman Ng. Welcome to Parallax Views. Peter Dill Scott and Freeman Ng, authors of Poetry and Terror, Politics and Poetics in Coming to Jakarta. How are you guys doing today?
Oh, it's lovely out here in California.
We're doing good.
So I wanted to have you both on to talk about this new book, Poetry and Terror. I feel that Mr. Scott's writing is actually very, very important, and I want more people to know about it. Maybe we could start with a sort of introduction. Peter, you're a man of many hats. I mean, you're a Canadian diplomat, an activist, a political writer, a poet. You know, you've done a great deal of things in your lifetime. But maybe we could get a sort of idea of who you are in your own words.
Well, I'm a Canadian. I got a PhD in political science, but I didn't like political science, and it was reflected in my PhD topic, which was the political ideas of T.S. Eliot, because I was also a poet, and that got me, luckily, in the end, it was my exit visa from political science. I ended up teaching English at the University of California at Berkeley. And as you said, for 4 years before I started here, I was a Canadian diplomat in Poland at the time of the Polish thaw. But there I got, in my work, a little bit of exposure to the problems in Indochina. And from the very beginning of my arrival in Berkeley, I was trying to tell Americans, don't get involved in a Vietnam War. It was a disaster for the French. So most of the time I was teaching English, I was also, as you mentioned, an activist in the Vietnam War, anti-Vietnam War movement. That really defined my life, and it defined my poetry too, including this book, original book of poetry, Coming to Jakarta, which focused on the huge massacre in Indonesia in 1965. And then, thanks to Freeman, who liked the poem, we did a series of interviews about it together, and that's the basis for the book we're talking about now, Poetry and Terror.
Well, Freeman, I think that's a good point to kick it over to you on. Peter is saying that you read his poetry, particularly Coming to Jakarta, and I just was curious, how did you become familiar with Mr. Scott, and not only his poetry, but his political writing?
Right. Well, my first acquaintance with Peter was as his student. I was a Cal student, and I took some classes from him, including a poetry workshop. And at the time I had no idea about any other side of his life. He was just, you know, an English professor. I think you brought in one day to our workshop the introductory poem to Listening to the Candle. No one ever had a 50th birthday quite like mine.
Yeah, right.
But that was a very isolated thing. None of us, I think, realized that it was a glimpse into this whole other side of your life. After I graduated, I naturally tried to find poetry by Peter. I always tried to find the poetry of the teachers that I had in my life.
Can I comment real quick on that?
Yeah.
I was just going to say, it's very interesting to me. I've noticed in a lot of, generally politically left-leaning poetry groups online, on social media, a lot of people are rediscovering Peter Dale Scott, the poet. So I think that's a really cool thing.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. That's what I want to be remembered for.
And the first thing that I discovered in my search was Coming to Jakarta. I guess the timing was just right that it had come out right about the time that I was kind of out of school, but still interested in keeping tabs on Peter. And so I read Coming to Jakarta and didn't understand hardly any of it. And so I called Peter up and I said, hey, this is a former student of yours. I just read Coming to Jakarta and I have a bunch of questions about it. Can I come sometime and ask them? And Peter responded, that's my favorite subject these days. So we met in his office at Wheeler Hall one afternoon, and that was the beginning of our friendship. That was the beginning of our reconnecting after I graduated from Cal, and also a kind of a foreshadowing of the many sessions we would later have sitting together in his living room talking about Coming to Jakarta.
With a microphone.
Yeah, with a microphone and with lamps, lights, and cameras for the video series that we eventually did.
Well, I'm curious, Peter, you were mentioning that you were trying to warn America of the catastrophic events that would happen if we got involved in Vietnam. Just to clarify, because reading the book, I don't get the impression that you were necessarily, a Marxist or someone on the very, very, very far ends of the left, even though you were involved in the anti-war movement. Maybe you could talk a little bit about your sort of orientation and stances from the Vietnam War onward.
Well, I was born into a political family. My father helped start what we would call the Social Democratic Party of Canada. It was once called the CCF, the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, and is still there as the NDP, the New Democratic Party. It was recently, a few years ago, was the official opposition in Canada, and it's been the provincial government in four or five provinces. So I was defined at birth as a kind of non-communist social democrat. And I had many, many issues with my father, but my politics remained very much what his were, optimistic, believing that you don't need to burn the building down in order to improve it.
Would it be okay if we talked a little bit about your family, because I feel like they play an important role in this book, Poetry and Terror, and also your poetry just in general. Your father, of course, was F.R. Scott, the Canadian poet and constitutional lawyer, and your mother was the painter, Marianne Dale Scott.
Yes. And the Coming to Jakarta is dedicated to my father, but it's part of a series, a trilogy. And the next volume, Listening to the Candle, which is not political, but about the small, pleasant details of life, is a yin poem and dedicated to my mother. And then the third one is dedicated to my wife. My father, what can I say? He got a law degree, but he started to practice just at the beginning of the Depression. And which hit Canada very hard. And like in America, there were masses of unemployed who were getting no support, starving. And he became a bit of a spokesman for them. And that led really to the formation of the CCF party. He was one of the founders of that party. And my mother was never so actively political, but she had more friends who were communists than my father did. My father was usually fighting communists on various issues. My mother also knew a great many French Canadian painters, and quietly painted, but I think her memory is going to grow in time as people appreciate not just her painting, but her views on life. There's been a biography of her, biography of each of my parents. I wasn't comfortable living with famous people, so that's why I took flight from Canada and came down to California, where I still am.
Well, I wanted to ask one more question that comes up in the book concerning your father, F.R. Scott. I believe he had issues with, I guess, what people would call the deep state, I guess, tapping of phones. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that and, you know, seeing that in your very formative years.
Well, if we're talking about the mid-30s, mid to late-30s, when I was about 7 or 8, in those days, it was called tapping because what you heard was a tap, tap, tap on the line. And one of my, introductions to adulthood was that there were people who were listening in on the phone. It was the RCMP. But my father was in a very strange status because he became connected with a group in America called the Institute of Pacific Relations. And these included some quite high up scholars in America. And they were very interested in China policy. And after the war, when there was a big question in America, who lost China? And there was going after people in the State Department who they blamed, I think quite wrongly. It's not as if something in Washington determined the fate of China. It was just that some people in Washington were smart enough to see that the old Kuomintang was hopelessly corrupt and that whatever you thought of them, the communists were going to be the future. Well, these people came in from a lot of attack from Joe McCarthy and people like him. And these were people my father knew. And actually, there's a whole set of hearings, which in my own political research, I looked into the Institute of Pacific Relations hearings. And by gosh, there was my father named among all the others. So he was being tapped by the RCMP. But he was also part of this IPR that was being investigated by people like Joe McCarthy a decade later in the States.
And I guess moving into coming to Jakarta, I guess we have to sort of describe where you're coming from with that poem. And what I mean by that is, I have a lot of younger listeners that may be unfamiliar with sort of the main topic of the poem or one of the main subjects, mainly the Indonesian genocide. Maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit about that, because I personally think it's one of your great contributions was revealing a lot of sordid details about that incident.
Well, I'll talk about what became the subject matter of the poem. It didn't begin that way. I had a personal crisis. I thought I was going insane. Some people would say it was just a panic attack. I think it was a bit more than that. But for a terrible 24 hours. And at the beginning, I was just healing myself and not knowing where the writing was going. And it's only a few pages in, I realize it's going to be a poem about terror. And it's a few more pages after that when I suddenly realize that I want to write about Indonesia. part of my sense of craziness was that I knew that America in 1965 had supported a massive, massive massacre in Indonesia of the Communist Party. This was after some Americans who I talk about in the poem had actually been saying we have to work for the elimination of the civilian cadres of the communists. That meant getting rid of the largest party in Indonesia. It was something. The party itself had about 2 million members, and now they think maybe even more than 2 million people were massacred in 1965. And I knew this, and I knew that America was involved, and I thought Americans should know, but I was absolutely not getting through, and I was carrying around in my head all this terrible stuff that was making me sick. And ultimately what cured me was writing the poem. But I have to say also the healing wasn't finished with the poem. That Freeman and I talked, I think there are 22 hours of tapes talking about the poem, and I began to realize things about the poem and about myself working with Freeman. And then finally editing the poem for the book, there's stuff in the book that I'm realizing, very important stuff that I'm realizing in the book, editing the talks, which themselves were a revelation about the poem, which taught me, got me a way out of my sickness.
Well, I wanted to comment real quick. When we're talking about Indonesia, I mean, it led to the fall of Indonesian President Sukarno. And for years, the U.S. and British governments more or less denied any involvement, especially the CIA, although I believe in 2017, declassified documents came out showing that the CIA had detailed knowledge of the massacres that started in Jakarta, and I believe went, you know, even into places like Bali.
Yes, it ended up in Bali. There's two different levels of what I would call U.S. involvement. There was what was called a left-wing communist coup on the 30th of September. I've always thought it was a false flag coup, that it was actually engineered by the generals as a pretext for retaliating against the communists. That's still in debate. What's not in debate is that a very methodical 7 or 8 months of assassination followed. And America was assisting that. They were sending small arms and small planes to fly the Indonesian special forces from place to place. And at a certain point, I can quote, actually, there's a whole volume of the State Department Foreign Relations series supposed to come out after 25 years. For some reason, the Indonesian volume waited a very long time. And even after it was released, then the CIA tried to get all the copies back. We had a copy at the Berkeley Library and the University of California Library in Berkeley, and they were fighting to get it back. And there was a huge bagarre, people saying, no, you cannot take back what is the official record of the State Department. I am proud to say I was a small part of that fight. And when it was released, we found things that, I'm just going to quote this, the U.S. ambassador to Indonesia at the time, Marshall Green, in early December 1965, recommended financial assistance for the activities of CAP Gestapo. Well, CAP Gestapo was a civilian movement dedicated to killing, and Marshall Green was saying they need money. And this is quoting the ambassador, the CAP Gestapo activities to date have been an important factor in the Army's program. What was the Army's program? Was to finish killing off the whole civilian background for the party. And judging from results, said the ambassador, I would say highly successful. You know, there's a whole book now by an economist called Brad Simpson about U.S. support for the massacre. It's not in question. And of course, they knew from the very beginning what was going on. They knew from the first weeks or so. And I want to make one other quote because it's much more polite, but it's, I think, in a way, kind of, to me, chilling. McGeorge Bundy, who was the national security advisor in the White House, after a few weeks of this, he sent a memo to the president, LBJ, saying, quote, "Events in Indonesia since the abortive September coup were a striking vindication of U.S. policy. They're watching a massacre take place. Rivers are being blocked by bodies." They actually talked about the problems of water traffic with so many corpses. And his response is that these events are a striking vindication of U.S. policy. So if somebody doesn't find something chilling about that, I think they've been conditioned to live in a country which has... It's a wonderful country, by the way. Don't get me wrong. I love America. I love Americans. I do not love what the American government was doing in the middle of the 20th century in Vietnam and Indonesia. And although there were no other massacres of the scale of Indonesia, there were many other places where governments were overthrown. And I would say that's... Because I believe in America, I would say that the government was not being true to the values of this country.
And really quickly, before we dive deeper into the poetry aspect, how did you become familiar with the topic of the Indonesian massacre? I mean, it wasn't talked about a lot in U.S. media. I mean, just like we didn't talk about things like, you know, Cambodia and whatnot. How did you find out about this?
Well, that's actually in the poem a bit, because as I was enough involved with the anti-war movement so that I got one or two invitations to speak abroad. And actually, the CIA usually managed to frustrate those two. Planes wouldn't take off. I had two invitations. That's a whole long separate story. But I met somebody from Britain called Malcolm Caldwell, and he more or less commandeered me. He said, "Peter, nobody's writing about this massacre. You've got to do it." And I said, "Well, I don't know anything about it." And he said, "Well, neither does anybody else. We're all outsiders." And I did do an article in 1975, which is 5 years before this breakdown I had, which led to the poem. So on the basis of that equipment, I had Indonesia in my head and I was obsessing with it. But I did most of the work on my own. And then later, because I did the poem, I told Noam Chomsky that I had been learning certain things, and I gave him the details, and he said, "Oh, I'd like a memo on that." And I produced a memo of 120 pages, and I ended up debating Bill Colby, who was the East Asia desk of the CIA at the time of the massacre.
The Phoenix program. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, well, he did Phoenix in Vietnam. And you could have said, I can't, they're pretty much in the same time frame, really. But Phoenix was a formal program. What was done in Indonesia was primarily the Indonesian army with covert assistance from the Americans. And of course, Colby said, "Well, there's nothing to it." But what I debated with him became an article, and that's one of the chapters in the book, Poetry and Terror, because it was a very, very successful article in Indonesia. The Indonesian government officially banned. My article became a book in Indonesia, a buku, was translated and printed all clandestinely. three or four times. People were risking their lives by publishing it. And it was officially outlawed. I was on the list of banned books in Indonesia. I wish I could get banned in America. Maybe it would do something for my sales. And in the end, it was the basis for two very, very powerful films made by an American called Josh Oppenheimer. He was working out of Denmark. You don't see much of the really big stuff on this coming from America, I must say, even today. Josh is American. He worked out of Denmark. And he did these two films, The Act of Killing, and what is it, The Sound of Silence, the second one. These absolutely changed the situation in Indonesia. They too got banned. This is now by the civilian government that succeeded Suharto, the man who overthrew Sukarno. But even they didn't want to know the truth about this. But because we now have the internet, just banning the movie didn't stop people from seeing it. And for the first time, there is now discussion and actual excavation of mass graves. People are beginning to get to the truth of what happened there. And I'm very proud of the fact. I told Freeman in the interviews, I wrote this poem, will never have any influence on anything, but I still had to write it. And then I got an unsolicited email from a man I'd never heard of, Josh Oppenheimer, saying that he was doing these films and that he had been inspired in his work by what I had done, both in my prose article and, he said, and particularly in my poem Coming to Jakarta. So I was, that was very, very, very heartwarming for me.
Well, I'm curious, and this ties into a lot of what you're talking about in the book with Freeman, and also in the poem itself. You mentioned debating William Colby. For me, that would probably be a little bit of a chilling experience. You also talk in the book about meeting people related to the Dulles brothers, you know, who were sort of the foundations of what people call the deep state or the CIA, essentially, and the sort of American superpower project in the 20th century. Maybe you could talk about, you know, dealing with people like these relatives of the Dulles brothers and debating William Colby. It sounds like quite the experience.
Well, these are two. The Colby experience was completely different from the knowing cousin of the Dulles. Well, I met Alan Dulles's son at Oxford, but nothing special happened there. It was just, they come into the poem because it was my exposure to a kind of upper class. And in the section where I talk about knowing one of the Dulleses, I mention being at a country house in Ontario on Lake Simcoe, and a dog caught and killed a squirrel. And one of the sons-in-law in this old Canadian family rushed upstairs, found his baby, rushed downstairs, took the dead squirrel with blood all over it and rubbed the blood on his son's face, which is an old British custom of bloodying, which is connected with fox hunting and so on. And it was, to me, a symptom that the upper class has not totally forgotten the days when it was the warrior class, the knights, you know, who defended the country and so on. The Colby thing was amazing. I was at the Association of Asian Scholars, and it wasn't just me. There was an ex-CIA man called Ralph McGehee, who also was, he from firsthand experience, he was saying the CIA was involved. And we were the star of event. There was in the major ballroom at the Hilton Hotel in Washington. 1,200 people were there with some of the lapels said so-and-so CIA. And then there were other people with lapels who were the real CIA, the covert operatives who were saying. But even then, I had had help from some of the Asian scholars who shared my concern about Indonesia, but they didn't want to be seen with me at that event. And that's a whole other story in itself. I said at one point, somebody was speaking to me with a hushed voice. I said, "You're talking to me as if you thought we're being overheard or listened to." And he said, "Of course we are," he said. So that's with the CIA presence in an academic event. Well, I shouldn't have been surprised, really. I had other experience of it.
Well, what do you make of the CIA's involvement in these things? I know in the poem, Coming to Jakarta, you try to find, I think you try to understand people like the Dulles brothers in it, even though you're adamantly opposed to their sort of project of what they want America to be. How did the Dulles brothers and the CIA factor into your poetry and sort of your coming to grapple with their responsibility in these massacres?
Okay, I'll talk a bit about the Dulles brothers, but the real denouement in all of that political discussion, that's a rather tough area of the poem. It's leading up to the fact that I realized towards the end of that not just the Dulles brothers had been involved in this, but so had the University of California. And not only that, but when I wrote about this in 1975, I had sort of discounted the role of the University of California. I said training people to be economists, not the same thing as training people to fight and kill. But if you're training people to be capitalists and economists in a country which is given to a socialist economy, you're training people to take over after a coup. So that means you really are involved. And the fact that I didn't want to recognize that meant that I, too, was involved. So, yes, the Dulles brothers were also involved. But, you know, in a way, this is something America, we're all enjoying more than our share of world resources because of a foreign policy of the CIA and the State Department, which has resulted in many, many parts of the world enjoying much less than their share of the world's resources, so that our wealth has been based on others' poverty. And it's always been that way. You know, people talk about Athens as being a wonderful example of democracy in classical times. Athens had 87,000 slaves. And it was much worse to be a slave in Athens than it was to be a slave in any other city. Rome, the same thing. Rome developed a notion of law and liberty, and it was wonderful for the people at the top. But meanwhile, their slaves were being raped, killed, and they were, if you were, the slaves came from captive armies, and the army, you had a choice. You could volunteer to be a gladiator, which meant you would probably end up being killed in public in front of a great crowd. Or if not, then you were an enemy of Rome, which meant you were executed summarily, but also in public before the gladiatorial games. I'm saying all this because in a way, we, America, with our rich and our poor, really are the successors to Greece and Rome, with both the liberty and also the impoverishment and the enslavement of others.
Well, I want to kick it over to Freeman a second here, but I guess the thing I really want to get at is you mentioned having this dark night of the soul moment where you felt like you were going mad. And I think that ties into what you were talking about with regards to there's this realization when you read about the massacres or when you say, you know, I was listening recently to Reverend Wright's famous 9/11 sermon, Reverend Jeremiah Wright. Everything he says in that sermon about our interventions in other countries, whether it's Guatemala, Chile, Iraq, I mean, we've left a trail of blood. And I think we as Americans don't want to look at that. You know, Reverend Wright was harshly criticized for that, although I don't think he was saying, you know, all Americans are horrible people, but he was pointing out that we don't want to look in the mirror at times. Do you feel like that's part of that dark night of the soul?
Yes, I do very much think it. It's a problem for everybody. I say in the prose book, Poetry and Terror, that this we need to think of the term post-traumatic stress disorder, which only entered the dictionary, I think, in the 1980s after Vietnam, because when so many people came back with PTSD. But I think it does something to your psyche to be the beneficiary of murder, even if you have not directly witnessed it or been anywhere near it. We in California especially, I think, it's hard to live here and enjoy the beauty of this place, be completely unaware of the fact that 200 years ago, this territory was occupied by Indians who were mostly killed off with semi-official encouragement in the course of the 19th century, which was only, you know, less than 100 years before I was born. I think that to be in civilization is, first of all, a great privilege. I mean, I'm glad I'm in a civilization, but it comes at a price. And the price is that you become, in a way, complicit with an order, which a social setup, which is doing terrible things. And you're not going to get free of that responsibility by signing a petition or writing a letter to the editor. It calls for something more serious.
Well, with that being said, I want to kick it over to Freeman. You talk a little bit about this, and I believe sort of a few introductory remarks that you make about taking on this project with Peter. You know, this idea of we don't know whether civilization, the experiment of human civilization is going to work out, but we need to be optimistic. There's a lot of conflicting emotions, I think, that go into examining, you know, our own culpability and the blood on our hands at times.
Exactly. And this is the aspect of Peter's writing and his thinking and just his character that most draws me, is that Peter doesn't just sort of expose the crimes of these other people, these dark figures, as you describe them, but he explores the commonalities between these forces and himself. You know, he admits his own complicity in these things. He is open to the humanity of these dark figures like the Dulleses. One of my favorite lines from Coming to Jakarta is, and we discussed this several times in the course of our interviews, not just in the discussion of the passage where it occurs, but it's the world like myself in its unintegrated desires. And that's what made me want most to have these video discussions with him in the first place and then to turn them into a book, because I thought that was the part, that was the aspect of his work that was the most important. Not just the factual work, not just the fact finding and uncovering, but the urging of this sort of spiritual component to the problem. I guess you could say that it's, describe it as the combining of poetry with politics, but I would, you know, that's sort of the most superficial way that you could sort of describe it.
There's an important point in the poem where the climax at the end of part two is when I realize, yes, that my university's been involved, and one of my co-professors, Guy Pauker, was actually encouraging the Indonesian army to be as ruthless as the Nazis. That's what he was saying. He expressed disappointment with the army that they hadn't shown the ruthlessness that the Nazis had shown when they killed off the communists in Germany. And then I realize that I'm part of the problem, and I start a whole new part of the poem talking about problems in myself. And it really begins with the lines, to have learnt from terror to see oneself as part of the enemy can be a reassurance. Because even if I have completely failed in trying to change America's involvement with evil, yes, I can do something about my own involvement with evil. So it really was. That was a very healing moment in the poem when I realized that I was part of the problem, which meant also I could work towards a solution. And the poem moves into that sort of efforts at the end. So
the word reassurance at the end of that passage was a surprise to me when I first read it. Mm-hmm. To have learned from terror to see oneself as part of the enemy can be a fill in the blank. And probably the last word I would have picked would be reassurance. But that's, I think, part of the value of what of the poem and what you do.
Well, there is a dialectic to the poem, and that is, you might call, the crux of the dialectic.
Well, you know, what's interesting to me is I feel that coming to Jakarta, when I read it years ago now, it was even more effective to me than a lot of your really brilliant prose writing. I mean, Drugs, Oil and War, The War Conspiracy, they're all great books, but coming to Jakarta just hits another level. Because you talk about essentially how coming to Jakarta came about. You know, it was written frantically in about 6 weeks after what amounted to a panic attack after the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980. And you describe sort of sleepless tossing and just becoming convinced within a span of a few hours that your 3 decades of work that you put in to trying to make America a more just society, you came to believe for a period that that was at best fruitless or perhaps even counterproductive. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that and the role of trauma in this poem.
Yes, well, it was traumatic. I don't want to overstate it, so I use the term panic attack, but it was really, at the time, it was not just that I felt I was going insane at that moment, but that really I had been building up all my life to go insane. And that nothing I had done made any sense at all. It was the fact that I had been trying to do all these things was just proof of how insane I was. And I wasn't sure that I was going to get any better. It definitely was writing the poem that calmed me down. But at the first, it was kind of trauma room emergency treatment, and the poem flaps around wildly in different directions. The political part of the poem I don't think is very good poetry, but it was necessary for me to work through all of that to realize that I'm not an innocent Canadian writing about bad Americans. I'm in this game like everybody else. And that's what engaged me. I'm so glad it's really very heartwarming to me to hear you say that you find that the poem works on a deeper level than my prose books. I feel the same way. And I'm so grateful to Freeman because I have been writing a series of quite serious prose books, The American Deep State being the last big one. But I was getting no spiritual nourishment from it, and I'm beginning to wonder if I was going to have another breakdown because it was becoming more than I could bear. And then Freeman did these interviews. Freeman suggested we do the book, and we worked about 5 years, didn't we, on this book?
If you count both the interviews and the writing of the book, yeah, it spanned that.
Well, I certainly spent 2 or 3 years editing the interviews that I had made and both learning from them and also correcting them. And this I found nourishing. And I wanted to just say, in terms of, if you know, I'm now 90, I don't know how many more books I'll write, but Poetry and Terror is the first time that I am writing about politics and poetry together, the importance of poetry to politics and the importance of politics to poetry. I really believe that the personal is the political, and that poetry should, we need poetry at any rate, which works in that spectrum. And my next book, which is now out to a publisher being evaluated, which is a biography of Czesław Miłosz, is about a Polish poet I worked with who talked about his own poetry as a form of poetic politics. And now I'm at work on a third book, and everything I do from now on will mix poetry and politics. I won't just be doing the politics anymore. I'll leave that to younger people.
Well, before we start wrapping up, your feelings on poetry, I want to get into that a little bit because, you know, today I was looking at my copy of Gary Webb's Dark Alliance, which your blurb for that book is right on the cover. And I remember watching interviews of Gary Webb after he wrote The Dark Alliance about Iran-Contra and the drug trade in America and how it all tied in. I remember him saying in interviews that he felt that when he was growing up, journalism was something that mattered, that it could change the world. And he said, but what he realized was after writing Dark Alliance, that was really the first big story he covered. Before that, he covered small stories, and you know, no one really cared.
He got a Pulitzer, by the way.
He did. But I guess he said in one of these interviews, and it was after all the smears happened against him. He said, you know, I don't think journalism can change the world because look what they did. You know, they smeared me. What was I able to do? And I feel like he lost a lot of faith in journalism. But in contrast, you sound like you haven't lost any faith in poetry. And I wanted to know, why haven't you lost that faith in poetry? Why do you think it's still able to change us?
Yes, before I do that, I'd like to say a word about Gary. He did not see the good results from his work. And we're in the middle of it. You know, we have this huge immigration problem, which really is a problem. But the problem is because there are gangs in El Salvador and Guatemala and Honduras, and essentially those countries are being run by gangs because of the overthrow of legitimate democratic governments, particularly in Guatemala, by the CIA. And I think that Gary did contribute to an awareness of the role of drugs in this. Of course, we're still in the middle of it, so we don't know if there will be a solution. But I think there is a better chance of a solution because of Gary. Now, for myself, I attribute it to the fact that I come from a smaller country, Canada, where it's not crazy to think that what you do can have input into the government. When I was an undergraduate at McGill, I heard the Minister of Justice in Canada, who was Pierre Trudeau's father-in-law, came and made a statement about the Japanese during the war, which I thought was libelous and untrue. He said the Japanese had been traitors, and I said, I never heard of any Japanese being traitors. And he said, oh, one of them was shot. And so I wrote to an MP in Ottawa and said, can you ask a question in Parliament? And the question was asked, were any Japanese shot during World War II? And the answer was, from the government this man represented, the answer was no. Well, that kind of, I mean, it meant very little, but to me it meant that action can bring results. And it's easier, I think, to have that illusion, I'll call it that, if you come from a small country. It's extremely difficult for an American to have that sense. And I must say, having worked for a long time with first Ron Dellum's office and Barbara Lee's office, I never got the kind of sense of achievement in any of those interventions that I did when I was a teenager back in Canada.
Well, I just wanted to add to that real quick. You know, in terms of Gary Webb, I just want to say this. I was just talking to Travis View, who writes for the Washington Post. And, you know, privately he said to me, you know, someone like Gary Webb, basically, he was wrongly smeared. And, you know, now Gary Webb, there's a whole movie about him, Kill the Messenger. I think Gary Webb's a hero in a lot of ways. I think what he did was very important. So maybe his day has come. Freeman, maybe you could comment on the importance of poetry and the nature of poetry and what it can do for the world.
Well, for me, it's not so much poetry specifically as this kind of openness in Peter's poetry, this sort of welcoming of contradictory positions, this sort of acceptance of depths in the depths in of the human soul and its capability for both good and evil.
I was going to say real quick, one of the parts that I really liked was when you two were discussing Ezra Pound, because I have to be honest, I'm not a big fan of Ezra Pound. I feel like Pound was extremely anti-Semitic. I'm very uncomfortable with Pound. I think he was a great poet, but I'm very conflicted about it. And it was very interesting to see you guys sort of try to delve into Pound's humanity while also looking at that dark side of him.
Right. I would also sort of conclude by making a comment on what Peter just said about his own hopefulness, about the ability to have an effect. And then he calls it a delusion.
Delusion.
An illusion.
Not an illusion. Delusion. No.
Yes. And I've also heard him at other times speak very candidly, and both in person and in his poetry, very candidly about his powerlessness or his feeling that nothing he's done has had an effect. The willingness, the ability to make both those statements at once, the ability to be at peace with both those statements and their contradictory natures is, I guess, what I would, if you call that poetry, then I would say, then that's my answer about poetry. But I think maybe it's something a bit beyond poetry even.
I have a very recent poem called Mornness, and where I talk about, and this is a quote from the poem, our need as humans to be more than we are. I think that anyone who's an activist in a good sense will derive a sense of fulfillment whether or not you see the results of your activity. If you're only in the activity to win, you're very likely to be disappointed. But if you're in the activity because you know you're doing something good, then you get a nourishment from that, which is better than a fancy meal at a fancy restaurant or touring Samoa or all these kind of frivolities that don't really contribute to the nourishment of our souls.
Well, there's just one more thing I wanted to ask about, and this doesn't have to do so much with poetry and terror. This is more sort of in line with where we are current events-wise, if that's okay. I wanted to ask you, Peter, about, you've written a lot about deep politics and, you know, this concept of the deep state. And I mean, I don't know that you originated the term. I believe there's a lot of debate about where that term comes from, if it comes from.
Oh, no, I could be quite simple. I did invent the term deep politics. I don't know if anyone in Turkey ever was aware of what I wrote, but the term deep state certainly comes from an event in Turkey in 1996, and then a Swedish intellectual, Ola Tenander, applied the term to America And I was lucky enough to be at a conference with him, and I picked up the term, and I think in my Road to 9/11 came out in 2007. As far as I know, that is the first book ever that came out in America applying the term to America, but I definitely did not invent it, and the Turks did.
Well, I guess what I wanted to ask you in regards to this is, there's a lot of people that like to use the term deep state or even deep politics now that I think really have grossly disfigured both terms. I think I hear a lot of people throwing out the most crazy, wild conspiracy theories they can rather than looking at, you know, I think conspiracies happen. I think deep political events happen. I think structural issues happen, but that seems very different from what a lot of people are calling the deep state now, or when people talk about deep politics. I just wanted to get your take on how these terms are used now, sort of by the mainstream or maybe the right wing.
Yes, well, I think that I would compare the way it's being used, mostly by Trump supporters, but even sometimes by other elements as well. They're like flatlanders who are living in two dimensions only. The whole point about deep politics is that there are elements above and below that are not really visible, the upper world and the underworld, that are part of the power structure of our country. And you have to go to the paperback edition of my book, The American Deep State, to see my argument that, yes, there is a deep state and Trump is part of it. I had Wall Street in the original subtitle of the book. It's not big money, because I think with the developments of the new century, the new millennium, people like the Koch brothers and Rupert Murdoch, they're not Wall Street, they're not old money, but they really have changed the politics of this country. Fox News came first before Trump, and Fox News is emphatically one part of the deep state battling another part of the deep state. We have a huge war on science now. That is perhaps the underlying generality that explains so much of what Trump is doing and why there was big money that helped elect him so he could do it. And no one ever talks about the oil companies. Well, big oil is part of my subtitle for my book. We know that Trump is a global warming denier. We know that Putin is, because Putin has to sustain the market for oil and gas, because if that market goes, Russia will be bankrupt. But we don't remember that the biggest forces behind this are the big oil companies of this country, not just the marginals like the Koch brothers, although they are the largest privately owned oil company in America, but the regulars, Chevron and Exxon, quite prepared to accept that things have to be done, but they want it done very slowly because their wealth is mostly still in the ground and they want to get it out for a profit before over to something else. And one of the key statistics, I think, is that in the 2016 election, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce devoted 70% of its political gifts to the Trump campaign, 30% to Hillary and the Democrats. And I'm sure that was the consensus of the major petro industry firms as well. And that's where deep politics is the role of dark money completely selecting our candidates. You know, you don't get to debate in the Democratic debate for the primaries if you don't have the money. That's what they call the private primaries before the public ones winnow it down to the people who are backed by enough money so that the public are given the privilege of voting for them. But the first choice is done at a higher level or a deeper level. So I think that it is quite appropriate to apply deep politics to the situation we're in now. But I wouldn't just reduce it to Trump versus the FBI. That's a bit of the deep state, but the deep state is a lot deeper than that.
Well, I would add to that. I don't know if it was you or someone else in an interview once. Someone was asking you about Wall Street, and they were going on about Murray Rothbard, the libertarian thinker. And I believe it was you or someone also working in this area of deep politics that said, well, he had connections to old money as well. And I think about that in relation to now, where we have people like Steve Bannon talking about the deep state, and yet Steve Bannon is a member of a secretive group called the CNP, which you've also talked about. And I think your work, what it has done for me, is it's made me see that there are these multiple levels of power at work. I think in right. a lot of ways it complements the work of C. Wright Mills and power elite theory. And I think it's going to be very important to study in the 21st century.
Joe Cannon, in his Cannonball, he did a recent article about the present crisis. We pointed to the role of the Federalist Society, the right-wing conservative legal group that selects all the judges for the Republicans to put in the courts. And the connections that the key activist there is a man who's also a member of the Sovereign Knights of Malta, which is a semi-secret Catholic group that had as members James Angleton of the CIA and Bill Casey of the CIA and maybe Alan Dulles of the CIA. And these people have agendas which are much more long-lasting than just electing one president or another president. And we have to be aware of these facts. But as I say, that's not where my heart is now. I'm letting other people do that kind of research. I want to see how the whole anti-war movement was inspired by people like Bob Dylan and Joan Baez. And that culture is something that changes countries, too. And I want to make a small contribution to our culture.
I guess in closing, I want to give you guys a chance to tell listeners how they can get a hold of the book, Poetry and Terror. And maybe also, Peter, since you dedicated previous books to your father, you know, you've said that your mother had a big influence in this book. You write right at the beginning, for Daniel Ellsberg of Pentagon Papers fame. Maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit about why you dedicated the book to Daniel Ellsberg, and then Freeman can tell us how we can get a hold of the book.
Yes, in very quickly, in the poem, the very end of the poem, I'm talking about a Dan as an example of somebody who has melded his knowledge with power. And I give an example of how he and Allen Ginsberg protesting the production of nuclear weapons in Colorado, sat down on a railway track, not knowing that a train was going to come very soon and not knowing what the train would do. And actually about 20 people sat on the track. But as the train came around the corner, puffing and chewing and blowing its bell, suddenly there weren't 20 people on the track. There were only two. Dan and Alan. And that's the climax of the poem. So that's the first reason. But Dan is a good friend of mine. He was best man at my wedding. And I gave him the manuscript of Poetry and Terror to read. And he saw enough of his own frustrations to be very involved in the manuscript and make some very helpful suggestions. And there's a whole new part of the book that's in there because of what Dan suggested. So it seemed appropriate to dedicate the book to him. By the way, just so you don't, I'm not totally optimistic, my kindly poem, Listening to the Candle, ends at the same point in the poem. It's my friend Brian Wilson also sitting on a train track, knowing what happened with Dan Ellsberg and Allen Ginsberg. He sat on the track, and the engineer had been told there's a terrorist sitting on the track. Brian was 100% nonviolent. And the engineer, instead of slowing down and stopping, he actually speeded up. Brian lost both his legs. His skull was split open so you could see his brain. And he's still alive, but he's never been quite the same since. So you have to balance the good and the bad, the yin and the yang. Life is a question of finding equilibrium out of all the terrible and wonderful things that we live among.
Well, Freeman, I want to, since you haven't got to speak that much in this interview, and I'm sorry about that, I want to give you a chance to tell listeners how they can get a hold of the book. And also, I want to let listeners know, we were talking about Malcolm Caldwell earlier. People should look up that name, because there is a deep political event that is related to him, namely his passing. And I think listeners should look into that. Freeman, would you like to take it away for us?
Yeah, well, first I'd like to say that I'm very happy to let Peter do all the talking. The whole point of this project was to bring Peter's work more into the public consciousness, to make it more accessible, more available. And so anybody who wants to read more about the book or order it or whatever, you can go to www.poetryandterror.com.
And Peter and Freeman, I would like to thank you once again for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you.
Thank you. I always enjoy good questions.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Professor Peter Dill Scott and Freeman Ng. And I highly recommend checking out both Peter's prose and poetry. What did you think of this edition of Parallax Views? Drop me a line with your comments on Twitter at ViewsParallax or through email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. If you enjoyed this edition of the program, please consider supporting me on Patreon, where you can hear the Parallax Views current events program, The Week That Was, as well as additional bonus content, such as raw video conversations from the Parallax Views main show. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.